Her mother had left home when the USS Millicent was only 5, running off very abruptly with a man sent by what had then been called Con Edison to do a free home energy efficiency assessment. It had been 6 years since she'd laid an eyeball on her old man, but to the best of her recall, he was almost 3 meters tall and morbidly obese, which had been why every mirror and bathtub in the house had been double width. One older sister, who'd been deeply involved in synchronized swimming, had got pregnant and married in high school soon after her mother's departure. All this time, there's been more crackling and crashing off up the hillside. Mario has trouble on any kind of declined grade. Some sort of birds sitting in the top branch of a little tree and looking at them without saying anything. Mario thinks suddenly of a joke he remembers hearing Michael Pemulis tell.
If 2 people get married in West Virginia and then pull up stakes and move to Massachusetts, and then if they decide they want to get a divorce, what's the biggest problem getting a divorce?
The USSMK says her other older sister had at just 15 joined the Ice Capades of all things and was in the backup-like chorus where the biggest artistic challenge was not bumping into people and either falling or making them fall.
Getting a divorce from your sister... Because in West Virginia, Pemulis said, a lot of people who get married are brother and sister.
Hold my hand.
He was only joking, though.
By now the light was about the same color as the ash and clinkers in the bottom of a Weber grill. The USS Millicent Kent was leading them in a set of slightly diminishing circles. Then, she said, at age 8, she came home early from after-school drills at the USTA Junior Facility in Passaic, New Jersey, looking forward to slipping into the old leotard and getting in some modern interpretive dancing up in her room, only to come home suddenly and find her father wearing her leotard, which, needless to say, didn't fit very well. And with a small front portion of his huge bare feet squeezed into a pair of strapless pumps Mrs. Kent had left behind in her haste. In the dining room, he'd moved all the furniture over to the side of, in front of, the really wide mirror, and a grotesquely tiny and bulging violet leotard, capering. Mario says violet's really the USS Millicent's color. She says that was the exact creepy word for it, capering. Pirouetting and rondling. Simpering as well. The crotch of her leotard looked like a slingshot, it was so deformed. He hadn't heard her come in. USS Millicent asked Mario if he'd ever seen a girl's yin-yang before. Obscene mottled hirsute flesh had pooched and spilled out over every centimeter of the leotard's perimeter, she recalled. She'd had a voluptuous figure even at 8, she told Mario, but the old man was in a whole different-sized ballpark altogether. Mario kept saying, "Golly, Ned," all he could think of to say. His flesh jiggled and bounced as he capered. It was repellent, she said. There was no sign of a Husky 6 or any other model of tripod in any of the thickets and boscages. Her literal term for it was yin-yang. But her old man wasn't just a cross-dressing transvestite, she said. It turned out they always had to be a relative's female clothes. She said she always used to wonder why her sister's one-pieces and figure-skating skirts always looked so askewly baggy and elastic shot, since the sisters didn't exactly wear tiny little malnourished sizes themselves. The old man didn't hear her come in, and he capered and jeted for several more minutes until she happened to catch his simpering eye in the mirror, she said. That's when she knew she had to get away, she said. And Mario's own old man's admissions lady had called out of the blue that very evening, she said, like it had been fate. Serendipity. Kismet.
Yin-yang, Mario offered, nodding.
The U.S. Millicent's hand was large and hot and at the level of sogginess of a bath mat that's been used several times in a row in quick succession. Her second oldest sister, many years later, had informed the USSMK that the first time anybody'd had any inklings about the old man was an episode when the older sister was very small, and Mrs. K had sewed her a special costume complete with gold lame bow and arrow for playing Cupid in the school Valentine's Day pageant. And the sister school had got out early one day after an asbestos scare, and she'd come unexpectedly home and found the old man in the basement rumpus room, in tiny wings and hideously distended diaper, striking a pose from a rather well-known Titian oil in the Met's high Renaissance wing. And had struggled with denial and own perceptions doubting for quite some time thereafter, until an hysterical episode during rehearsals for an Icecapades Valentine's Day number brought all the feelings surging up and broke the denial. And the Icecapades Employee Assistance Office counseling staff helped her start to work it all through. At which point USS Millicent stopped them in an unprickly thicket of what later turned out to be poison sumac, and turned with a strange glint in the one eye that wasn't in pine shadow, and crushed Mario's large head to the area just below her breasts, and said she needed to confess that Mario's eyelashes, and vest with extendable police lock he used for staying upright in one place, had for quite some time now driven her right around the bend with sensual feeling. What Mario perceived as a sudden, radical drop in the prevailing temperature was, in fact, the USS Millicent Kent's sexual stimulation, sucking tremendous quantities of ambient energy out of the air surrounding them. Mario's face was so squashed against the USS Millicent's thorax that he had to contort his mouth way out to the left to breathe. USS MK's hair bow became detached and fluttered down through Mario's sightline like a giant crazed violet moth. USS MK was trying to undo Mario's corduroys, but was frustrated by the complex system of snaps and fasteners at the bottom of his police lock's Velcro vest, which overlapped his trousers' own fasteners. And Mario tried to reconfigure his mouth somehow to both breathe and warn the USS MK that he was incredibly ticklish in that area of the belly button and directly below. He could now start to hear his brother Hal somewhere to the above and east, calling Mario's name at a moderate volume. The USS Millicent Kent was saying there was no way Mario could be any more nervous than she was about what was happening between them. It's true that the sounds of Mario sucking air out of a severely leftward contorted mouth could have been interpretable as the heavy breathing of sexual stimulation. It was when the USS Millicent wrapped one arm around his shoulder for leverage and forced her other hand up under the hem of the tight vest and then down inside the trousers and briefs, rooting for a penis, that Mario became so ticklish that he began to double up, clearing his face of USS Millicent's front and laughing out loud in such a distinctive, high-pitched way that Hal had no trouble beelining right upon them, compromised though his navigational systems were after 15 or so secret minutes alone in the fragrant pines. Mario later said it was just like when there was a word on the tip of your tongue that, try as you might, you can't remember until the exact second you stop trying, and in it pops right into your head. It was when the three of them were walking together, back up the hillside toward the tree line's lip, not trying to do anything but get back to ComEd, by the most direct route in the dark, that they stumbled upon the cinematic tripod, a dully glinting TL waffle-tipped husky, in the middle of what wasn't such a very tall or thick thicket at all. 30th of April, Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Steeply said, "Choosing Boston as your op center, after all, which to us signifies the place of the supposed entertainment's origin." Marat made a gesture of being willing to take time and play along, if Steeply wished it.
"But also the city Boston, USA, has logic. Your closest city to the convexity, closest therefore to Quebec. Within, as you say, the distance of speed."
His wheelchair squeaked very slightly whenever he moved. An automobile horn somewhere between the city and themselves blew a sustained blast. It grew always colder down on the desert floor. They could feel this. He felt gratitude for his windbreaker. Steeply flicked some ashes from his cigarette with a coarse thumb gesture that was not yet feminine.
"But we're not any more sure that they actually do have copies. Also, does this, quote, anti-entertainment the film's director supposedly made to counter the lethality, does it really also exist? This really could be some sort of game for you and the FLQ to hold out the promise of the anti-entertainment as a chip for concessions, as some kind of remedy or antidote.
47.
Of this anti-film, that antidotes the seduction of the entertainment, we have no evidence except craziness of rumors.
Steeply used a technical interviewer's device of pretending to occupy himself with small physical chores of preening and hygiene, delaying to have Marat elaborate himself more fully. The lights of the city Tucson, with their movements and twinkling, made a globe of light, such as on ceilings, at La Salle du Danser, in Val-d'Or, Quebec. Marat's wife was dying slowly of ventricular restenosis.
48.
He thought, die twice. Marat said,
and also, why do they never send you into the field as yourself, Steeply? This is to say, in appearance. The last time you were, a Negro? For almost 1 year, no?
USA person's shrugs are always as if trying to lift a heavy thing.
Haitian, Steeply said. I was Haitian. Some Negroid tendencies in the persona, maybe.
Marat listened to Steeply be silent. A USA coyote sounds more like a high-strung dog. The automobile's horn continued, sounding to the men forlorn and somehow nautical out below in the dark. The feminine manner to examine the fingernails was to raise the whole hands back into view, instead of malely curling the nails in over the upturned palm. Marat recalled knowing this from a very young age. Steeply would pick at the corners of his lip, then, for an interval, change to examining the fingernails. His silences seemed always comfortable and contained. He was a competent operative. More cold air came, odd eddied breezes up in over the shelf from the desert's floor, puffs of sudden air as if from the turning of a volume's pages. His bare arms had the plucked chicken look of chilled and bare skin in his grotesque sleeveless dress. Marat had not been aware of when during the falling of night Steeply had removed the absurd sunglasses, but decided the exact moment of this did not matter for reporting every word and gesture back to Monsieur Fortier. Again, the coyote. And also another farther off, perhaps to answer. The sounds were like that of a domestic dog being given low voltage.
Les assassins, Monsieur Fortier and Monsieur Burim, and some others of his comrades on wheels, believed Raymond Marat to be eidetic, near perfect in recall and detail.
Marat, who could remember several incidents of crucial observations he had failed to later recall, knew this was not true. The 30th of April, year of the Depend adult undergarment.
Several times also, Marat called USA to Steeply, your walled nation, or your murated nation. An oiled guru sits in yogic full lotus and spandex and tank top. He's maybe 40. He's in full lotus on top of the towel dispenser just above the shoulder pull station in the weight room of the Enfield Tennis Academy, Enfield, Massachusetts. Saucers of muscle protrude from him and run together so that he looks almost crustacean. His head gleams, his hair jet black and extravagantly feathered. His smile could sell things. Nobody knows where he comes from or why he's allowed to stay, but he's always in there, sitting, yogic, about a meter off the rubberized floor of the weight room. His tank top says Transcend in silkscreen. On the back it's got Deus Providebit in Dayglow orange. It's always the same tank top. Sometimes the color of the spandex leggings changes. The guru lives off the sweat of others, literally. The fluids and salts and fatty acids. He's like a beloved nut. He's an ETA institution.
You do like maybe some sets of benches, some leg curls, inclined abs, crunches. Work up a good hot shellac of sweat. Then, if you let him lick your arms and forehead, he'll pass on to you some little nugget of fitness guru wisdom. His big one for a long time was, "And the Lord said, let not the weight thou wouldst pull to thyself exceed thine own weight." His advice on conditioning and injury prevention tends to be pretty solid, is the consensus. His tongue is little and rough, but feels good, like a kitty's. It isn't like a faggy or sexual thing. Some of the girls let him too. He's harmless as they come. He supposedly went way back with Dr. Incandenza, the Academy's founder, in the past. Some of the newer kids think he's a creep and want him out of there. What kind of guru wears spandex and lives off others' perspiration, they complain. God only knows what he does in there when the weight room's closed at night, they say. Sometimes the newer kids, who won't even let him near them, come in and set the resistance on the shoulder pull at a weight greater than their own weight. The guru on the towel dispenser just sits there and smiles and doesn't say anything. They hunker then and grimace and try to pull the bar down, but like, lo, the overweighted shoulder pull becomes a chin-up. Up they go, their own bodies, toward the bar they're trying to pull down. Everyone should get at least one good look at the eyes of a man who finds himself rising toward what he wants to pull down to himself. And I like how the guru on the towel dispenser doesn't laugh at them, or even shake his head sagely on its big brown neck. He just smiles, hiding his tongue. He's like a baby. Everything he sees hits him and sinks without bubbles. He just sits there. I want to be like that. Able to just sit all quiet and pull life toward me, one forehead at a time. His name is supposedly Lyle. It was yours truly and C and poor Tony that crewed that day and everything like that. The AM were wicked bright and us a bit sick, however, we scored our wake-ups boosting some items at a sidewalk sale in the Harvard Square where it were warm upping and the snow coming off awnings, and then later poor Tony ran across an old Patty Citizen type of his old acquaintance from, like, the Cape, and poor Tony got over and pretended like he would give a blowjob on the house, and we got the citizen to get in his ride with us and crewed on him good, and we got enough dollars off the Patty type to get straightened out for true all day and crewed on him hard. And C wanted we should eliminate the Patty's map for keeps and everything like that and take his ride to this understanding slope strip shop he knows in Chinatown. But poor Tony turns white as a shit and said by no means, and put up an argument and everything like that. And we just left the type there in his vehicle off Memorial Drive. We broke the jaw for incentive not to eat no cheese. And C insisted and was not to be denied. And we took off one ear, which there was a mess and everything like that. And then C throws the ear away after in a dumpster. So yours truly is like, so what was the exact point to that like? The dumpster was with the dumpsters out by Steve's Donuts in the infield square. We go back to the Brighton Projects to cop, and Roy Tony was always there on his bench in the playground in late AM, but now all the project niggas was awake and out on the playground, and it was tense, but it was daytime and everything like that, and we cop half a bundle from Roy Tony, and we go down to the library at Copley, where we stash our personal works when we crewed, and went into the men's room, where there was several works on the floor already that early, and got straight into the stall, and C and yours truly had a beef about who shot three and who got two, and we made poor Tony give us up his third bag. And then, we had to cop for that night and tomorrow AM still, which was Xmas, and had to cop in advance. It's a never-ending struggle. It's a full-time job to stay straight. And there was no vacation for Xmas at any time. It's a fucking bitch of a life. Don't let anybody get over on you different. And back we go to Harvard Square. However, on arrival, poor Tony wanted he should hang for lunchtime with his red leather fags in the bow and arrow.
And pretty much I can tolerate fags when alone. But together, yours truly, I can't fucking stand fags. And yours truly and C said, fuck this shit. And we screwed out and go up to the central square, where it was cooling off and the awnings refreezing and everything like that, and snowing, and boosted NyQuil at the CVS drug, where we go to the mop aisle and deploy a mop handle and tilting the mirror over the NyQuil aisle and boosted NyQuil in C's coat and got messed up on NyQuil and scored a book bag off a foreign slope student type kid on the red line platform, but it only had books and discs. And the disc case was fucking plastic and into a dumpster with it goes. But also at this time, we come up and run into Kelly Vinoy that was working her corner by the dumpster by Cheapo Records in the square, by the email place, and she's dope sick having a conversation with Equus and another man. And Equus said, he said Stokely Darkstar just got free tested again at the Fenway and confirmed a big boot 8.8 he's got the virus for sure. And Purple Boy said, he said Darkstar said how if he was going down, he didn't give a shit and wasn't going to give a shit if he gave some others the virus through transmission. And the word was out and about, don't share Stokely Darkstar's works. Don't use works off Stokely Darkstar no matter how sick you are. Even if you're dying for it, get other works. Like C said, anything would count in your mind when you're sick and it copped and was minus works and Darkstar had works. We all, every crew with heads left, have personal works for only ourselves that we use, except blown-out old hoes like Kelly and Purple Boy. Their man takes their dollars and their works, and he's the only one can give them their shots and keep Kelly just this side of dope sick 24/7 for incentive for her to make him more dollars and everything like that. There's nothing worse than a pimp, and Boston pimps are the worst. They're 10 times worse than NYC pimps that are superest. To be so heartless in NYC, where yours truly peddled ass in the Columbus Square for a time of my youth, like Stokely Darkstar before departing for greener pastures. And we had a conversation, but we're coming down, and it was getting dark and snowing for a white Xmas, and if we didn't crew before like 2200, Roar Tony's niggas would be too drunk to keep them from beefing with us, and there'd be a beef and everything like that if we go to cop after 2200, and who needs a grief? So back we redline to the Harvard Square, and all the foreign students are in the bars, and we locate poor Tony smoking hash with fags back of Arbonne Paint, and say, let's roll a foreign student stuck here for Xmas in the bars and cop before 2200. And so we all go on the ice from the frozen melted snow to the bow and arrow in the square with poor Tony and Lola's sister and Susan T. Cheese, who I fucking can't stand, and got in there and made Susan T. Cheese buy beers, and we wait and no students are leaving alone to roll, but an older type individual who anybody could see is no student, but is legless on shots alone at the bar, fucking shattered, slumped over, is getting ready to depart for green pastures, and poor Tony lets Lola's sister to screw. She crews with poor Tony sometimes, but not if it's wet work. And with C's involvement, it's always wet work. And yours truly, I informed Susan T. Cheese. She knew better than not to screw as well, and the older individual departs, shattered, and holding on to walls, and a high class and promising coat for the possibility of money, and punts his old nose this way and that and everything like that. Through the bow and arrow window, C wipes the steam off and has a conversation with the Santa Claus ringing a big bell for the kettle, and we're like... Jesus, it's a never-ending struggle to wait and cop. But after a while, finally, after stiffing the Santa Claus, we watch he picks a direction, finally. At last, up Massachusetts Avenue toward the Central Square on foot, and poor Tony beats it around the block to get up in front of him around the block on the ice in his fucking heels, and feather snake around his neck and gets him. Somehow, poor Tony always knows how over to the dumpsters alley by Bay Bank off Sherman Street, and yours truly and C crew on the individual and roll him, and C messes up his older map to a large degree, and we leave him in no condition to eat cheese in a snowdrift of material under the dumpster. And C again wants to siphon out of a vehicle on Mass Ave and set him on fire, but he has $400 on his person, and then some. And a coat with a furry collar and a watch we really scored. And C even go so far to take the non-student shoes, which they don't fit,
and in the dumpster they go. Back we go to the Brighton projects, but it's post-2200. It's too late. Rotoni hasn't got his piss boys out. He's not open for commerce, and yet it is like a nigger convention in the playground of the Brighton projects, with their glass pipes and their crown royal and purple bags and everything like that in the playground of the projects. And if they smell we're holding this kind of dollar amounts, they will crew on us in numbers. They're animals at night with their purple velvet bags and P-dope and ready rock crack. One large nigger in a Patriot's hat has a hot incident. And down he goes on the blacktop by the swing set right in front of us, and none of his brothers, unquote, go so far as to do anything. He lays there. They're animals at night, and we screw out with Ricky Tick Speed from the Brighton Projects, and we converse. And poor Tony wants to just go over the line to the infield square and try to just cop P-dope from Delfina down by the Empire Hangars, or else what else hang with the fags at Steve's Donuts and hear who else is holding weight in the infield or Alston and everything like that. But Delfina's pee is from bunk. The word is out and about that it's all mannitol and quinine. You might as well fucking cop X-Lax or Schweppes. And see dope slaps, poor Tony. And C wants the red line down to Chinatown, but poor Tony turns white as a shit and says Chinatown's too dear in dollars and everything like that, even for, like, bundles. Dr. Wu is $200, but at least it's always good, but we have $400 and then some. And C points out we can fucking well afford Wu's well-known excellent ski for once at Xmas. And poor Tony stamps a high heel and says, but how we've got enough dollars to stay straight and get Lola Sister straight for Xmas, and I'll lay up. And not have to never end in struggle at Xmas, and two or more days after that, if we don't blow it on Xmas Eve in Chinatown instead of waiting. Which is a good punt, but when has anybody ever known C to ever wait? He gets dope sick faster than any of us, and everything like that. And it's all piss and vinegar for Wu, and starting with the shivers, and with the nose's mucus all ready, and everything like that, and C is not to be denied, and we say we are screwing down to Chinatown. And if Paul Tony don't want to come, he can take a, like, giant breath and hold it in the square until we get back and we'll cop for him. And Portoni says he might be a dick-sucking fag, but he's not a starry-eyed maroon. And so, off we go. And everything like that, with $400 on the orange line, and through a fucked-up circumstances, yours truly, and C almost end up raping an older-type nurse in a white nurse's uniform and coat on a train, but we don't. And but poor Tony seems white and detracted on the train, playing with his feather snake, and says, he seems in his mind maybe to recall an involvement in some type deal where Dr. Wu might have got slightly got over on and boinked, and that maybe down in Chinatown we could err on the side of low profiles and try to cop somewhere else except from the Wus. Except Dr. Wu is who we know. C is Wu's former acquaintance from crewing with Slopes on the north side for Whitey Sorkin in the days of his youth. C is not to be denied.
And so at the Orange Line tea stop, we grab a fat cab to about 2 blocks from Hung Toys and screw out of the cab at a light. And the thing with fat cabbies is they can't run after you. And poor Tony is pissed to watch tearing ass down the street in high heels with a feather stole. Poor Tony runs right by the front of Hung Toys, this by prior agreement, to wait for us, low profile, down the street, and yours truly and C go on Hung Toys, where they don't open till 2300 and sell tea, unquote, like Hunter-proof tea, to all hours and everything like that, and never get inspected because Dr. Wu has arrangements with Chinatown's finest. Xmas is non-celebrated in Chinatown. Dr. Wu, a good thing about Wu is he's always there in Hung Toys at known times. Here there's all old slope racial type ladies sitting in booths, eating noodles and drinking, quote, tea out of white cups the size of a shot glass and everything like that.
The small slope kids tear assing it all over, and older men in like Jew caps and skinny beards out of just the middle of their chin. But Dr. Wu is only middle-aged and wears iron glasses and a tie and looks more like a banker for a slope. But he is 100% business and ice cold all the way down for slope-type commerce. Plus, He's connected big time, and not to be fucked or got over on if somebody has a head lift. And yours truly, I can't believe Paul Turner would ever take part in trying to crew on Wu, who he knows through sea and even the smallest commerce. And if he did, she says he sure never heard about it, nor saw any other skeet or anything like that, and why? She's the one that knows Wu. We arranged Paul Turner to wait for us outside and try to be low profile. It's sub-zero snow, and he's in a leather spring coat and stole and brown wig that's not as good as a hat. And he'll freeze his low-profile balls off, and she was trying to smile. And he told Dr. Wood we needed 3 bundles, and Dr. Wood was smiling in his slope manner, said the boost in life must surely be excellent, and she laughed and said, most excellent. She's tight with slopes. He does the talking and everything like that.
And he says we're going to lay up low profile for the Xmas vacation and not crew, because I had a rape-type situation from an older nurse last night on the T and almost got pinched by the T's finest. And Dr. Wu nods in a special, subservient manner he uses for non-slopes, who he's really polite with. But he's a dictator to his slopes when we see him with his subservient slopes. But with us, we're all like most polite and everything, like conversation. And it's nice but expensive, but it feels nice at the time. But Wu finishes his so-called tea, and Wu goes back behind the curtains in the back of Hung Toys. That's a giant bright red curtain with purple mountains or hills and clouds that are flying snakes with leather wings. That is one curtain yours truly would want to boost for personnel hanging use. That nobody that is in a slope and isn't in with Wu can never go behind it. But you can see when he opens it and goes behind the curtain, it looks like merely more old slope ladies sitting on packing cases with slope writing. Even more noodles in bowls, they hold about like a millimeter from their yellow maps and everything like that. Slopes rarely stop shoveling in the old noodles. Stokely Dockstar calls them maggot eaters.
And the subservient slopes keep going in and out of the curtain while Wu's back there a longer than average time. And C's got the shivers, and starting to Jones. And dope fiends are full of superstition. And he says to yours truly, he says, the fuck, he says, maybe, what if poor Tony really did take part with Burning Wu? And what if a slope sees poor Tony outside and is one of these slopes going in and out of the curtain maybe telling Wu, like ratting out poor Tony as our acquaintance? And my mucus is starting and we're jonesing superstitiously over P.T., and where's Wu behind the curtain and everything like that, trying to smile and conversation ultra-low, drinking, quote, tea that's like schnapps, only worse and green.
And we jones. And Dr. Wu comes back, finally, at last, out smiling subserviently.
With all the wonderful skeet, 3 bundles in a newspaper. Who could fucking read it? But the pictures are of slope VIPs in suits. And Wu sits down. And Wu never sits down at the booth with the skeet. It isn't done in his commerce. And Wu's hands are folded over our skeet in the thing. And Wu, smiling, says, he asks C if we've seen good old Poor Tony or Susan T. Cheese around. We crew with Poor Tony in Boosting Life, did we not? He said. C, he says P.T. is a fucking dick-sucking fag queer and a proven cheese-eater. And we'd fucked up his map and cheese and Lola Sister's map in a beef. And in crew with fags since approx the autumn period. See his pouring mucus and trying to smile casually. Dr. Wu laughed in a hearty fashion and said, excellent. And Wu leaned over our skeet saying, if we should happen by chance to see poor Tony or them, to please give poor Tony his
quite best regards and wish him prosperity and 1,000 blisses and everything like that.
And we promote the newspaper a skeet. And Wu promotes our dollars, and very politely out we go. And I admit yours truly wanted we should burn poor Tony and Ricky take the fuck out of Chinatown, but we go over down more by the China Pearl place, and poor Tony's sort of hunched behind a light pole with his gray teeth chatting in his dress and thin coat, trying to be low profile in his red coat and heels around 1,000,000-plus slopes that are all subservients of Wu.
And later, after screwing out, we didn't tell him of what Wu said about sitting down and asking about him and Cheese's blisses and we screw to the orange line to our hot air blower grate we use at night at the library behind the Copley Square.
And we got our personal works out from behind the brickworks, behind the bush, by the hot blower grate where we stash our works. And we're eagerly into the first bundle, and we're cooking up, and notice poor Tony doesn't the least bit when yours truly and C tie off first in line, seeing as we're the ones that copped it, and poor Tony's got to wait as usual. Except I notice he doesn't bitch even a little.
Normally, poor Tony keeps up this usual whine yours truly learned how to not notice.
But when he doesn't whine now that we're jonesing and the skeet's right there, I notice he's casually looking like every place but at the skeet, which is unusual, and see jonesing with the shivers, cooking up trying to keep his lighter lid in the hot air's wind and snow of night. And I admit it, yours truly, I got a wicked cold inside feeling. Even with all this hot air from the blower grate blowing up from under us, making our hair blow around and Tony's feather snake perk upward, I yours truly get a cold feeling of superstition once more. You get wicked superstitions in this fucked up kind of shit life because it's a never-ending chase and you get too tired to go by much more than never-ending habit and superstition and everything like that, so...
But I don't say anything, but yours truly, I have a cold superstition about poor Tony not whining while he makes like he has to casually piss and takes a piss, and the piss steams up around the lower areas of the bush with his back turned away and isn't looking around with interest or anything like that. You never turn your back on the skeet when it's partly your skeet, which is wicked unusual.
Which she is so eagerly dopesick he doesn't notice anything past keeping the lighter lit. And so I admit it. I, yours truly, did, yours truly, purposely let C tie off and boot up first while I still cooked up. I did cook up unusually slow, fucking with the getting the snow melt hot in the spoon and everything like that. Yours truly, I let the lighter go out and took more time with the cotton. And C had the shivers worst of us and cooks up the fastest and would have got it anyway. Later, with C's map eliminated, poor Tony later conceded admitting Susan T. Cheese helped a Worcester fag get over on Woo for a fronted bottle in autumn is why. And all three bundles Woo give us in Slope News was hot shots. Laced. It started the instantly C undid the belt and booted up, we already knew. Yours truly, I and P.T. theorized it was Drano, with the blue, like, glitter shit and everything like that.
Taken out by subservient slopes, it had that Drano-like effect on C and everything like that. It was laced, whatever it was.
C started with the screaming in a loud, hot-pitched fashion instantly after he unties and boots, and down he goes, flopping with his heels panning on the metal of the blower grate, and he's at his throat with his hands, tearing at himself in the most fucked-up fashions. And poor Tony is high-heeling Ricky Tick over C, zipping up, saying he screams sweetie C, but and stuffing the feather snake from his neck's head in C's mouth to shut him up from high-pitched screaming in case Boston's finest can hear involvement.
And blood and bloody materials coming out C's mouth and C's nose, and it's all over the feathers. It's a sure sign of Drano, blood is. And C's eyes get beastly and bulge, and he's crying blood into the feathers in his mouth. And trying to hold on to my glove, but C's arms are going all over. And one eye, it like all of a sudden pops out of his map. Like with a pop you make with fingers in your mouth. With all this blood and material and a blue string at the back of the eye, and the eye falls over the side of C's map and hangs there looking at the fag poor Tony.
And C turned light blue and bit through the snake's head and died for keeps. And shit his pants instantly, with shit so bad the hot air blower grate is blowing small bits of fart and blood and misty shit up into our maps, and poor Tony backs off of Oversea and puts his hands over his made-up map and looks at C through his fingers.
And yours truly, I take the belt off, it goes without saying, and don't even rethink or dream about trying maybe a different bag out of a different bundle from C. For how could we know what bundle we'd cook up out of first? So all three bundles must be hot. So I don't even dream, even though yours truly, shivering and mucus sick already, and now in payback, Wu has our only dollars to get straight with for Xmas.
It might sound fucking low, but the reason we had to leave the deceased body C in one of the library's dumpsters is, the reason is because the Copley Square's finest know it is our personal hot air blower grate, and if we leave C there...
It's a sure pinch for us, as known acquaintance, and a period of kicking the bird and holding in a cell.
But the dumpster was empty of material, and C's head made a fucked-up sound when it hit the empty bottom, and...
Poor Tony cried and whined, and said... He said he had no inkling that Beast Wu was that vindicative.
And poor old deceased C, and how this was it. He's going to get clean from here on out and get a straight job dancing at a patty-type club in the Fenway and everything like that, and on, piss and wine. I didn't say anything. I had to rethink on the T to the square if yours truly. I should eliminate poor Tony's map for keeps. For payback, and how he purposely let C shoot up first, and would have let yours truly shoot first, even knowing. Or make that cheese move and go back down to Orange Line to Woo, and try to get enough bags to get True Straight eating cheese to Woo about the warehouse that poor Tony and Susan T. Cheese and Lola Sister with Equus crashed at now.
Or like what?
Yours truly, I almost was crying.
It was when poor Tony took off his high heels and wanted yours truly, I should boost him like over the edge of C's body's dumpster to get back what was left of his feather stole out of C's mouth, that yours truly, I thought, I decided what to do. But the connected slope Woo wasn't even there in front of the hung toys curtain in the early Xmas AM. And then poor Tony departed for green pastures and ate cheese. And it took yours truly 2 days of kicking a bird in the hall outside my mumster's apartment that for payback she locked the door before I, yours truly, could get in a detox to at least cop some methadone and get three squares to stay down in yours truly to start to theorize on what to try to do after I could stand up straight and walk upright again once more.
The 3rd of November, YDAU. Hal could hear the phone console ringing as he dropped his gear bag and took the room key from around his neck. The phone itself had been orange, and its plastic case was transparent, and you could see the phone's guts.
Yellow? Why do I always get the feeling I'm interrupting you in the middle of some, like, vigorous self-abuse session? It was Oren's voice. It's always multiple rings, then you're always a little breathless when you do.
Do what?
A certain sweaty urgency to your voice. Are you one of the 99% of adolescent males, Hallie? Hal never liked talking on the phone after he'd gotten high in secret down in the pump room. Even if there was water or liquid handy to keep the cotton at bay, he didn't know why this was so. It just made him uneasy. You're sounding hale and fit, oh? You can tell me, you know. No shame in it. Let me tell you, boy, I did myself raw for years on end on that hill. Hale estimated over 60% of what he told Oren on the phone, since Oren had abruptly started calling again this spring, was a lie. He had no idea why he liked lying to Oren on the phone so much. He looked at the clock. Where are you?
Home. Snug and toasty. It's 90 degrees out.
That would be Fahrenheit, I'm assuming.
The city is made of all glass and light. The windows are like high beams coming at you. The air has that spilled fuel shimmer to it.
So to what do we owe?
Sometimes I wear sunglasses even in the house. Sometimes at the stadium I hold my hand up and look at it, and I swear I can see right through it. Like that thing with the flashlight in your hand.
Hands seem to be sort of a theme to this call thus far.
On the way in from the lot off the street here, I saw a pedestrian in a pith helmet, stagger, and, like, claw the air and pitch forward onto his face. Another Phoenician felled by the heat, I think to myself.
It occurred to Hal that although he lied about meaningless details to Oren on the phone, it had never occurred to him to consider whether Oren was ever doing the same thing. This induced a spell of involuted, marijuana-type thinking that led quickly, again, to Hal's questioning whether or not he was really all that intelligent.
SATs are 6 weeks away, and Pemulus is less and less helpful on the math, if you want to know what I'm doing all day. The man's face made a sizzling noise when it hit the pavement, like bacon-caliber sizzling. He's still lying there. I see out the window. He's not moving anymore. Everyone's avoiding him, going around him. He looks too hot to touch. A little Hispanic kid made off with his hat. Have y'all had snow yet? Describe snow for me again, Hallie. I'm begging you. So you go around with this image of me sitting around during the day masturbating, is what you're saying? I've actually been thinking of maneuvering for the whole Kleenex concession at ETA, as a venture. That, of course, would mean actually contacting CT and the moms. Me and this forward-looking reserve QB have been making inquiries. Putting out feelers, volume discounts, preferred vendor status, maybe a sideline in unscented lubricants. Any thoughts? Oh, I'm sitting here actually missing New Orleans, kid. It'd be just coming up on Advent, I think. The quarter always gets really quaint and demure during Advent. It almost never rains down there during Advent for some reason. People remark on it. The phenomena. You sound somehow a little off to me, O. I'm heat-crazed. I might be dehydrated. What's that word? Everything's looked all beige and powdery all day. Trash bags have been swelling up and spontaneously combusting out in the dumpsters. These sudden rains of coffee grounds and orange peels. The displacement guys in the barges have to wear asbestos gloves. Also, I met somebody. Hallie, possibly very special somebody. Oh, dinner time. Triangles are clanging over in West. Hey, Hallie, though. Hang on. Kidding aside for a second. What do you know about separatism? Hal stopped for a moment. You mean in Canada? Is there any other kind? Ennett House Drug and Alcohol Recovery House.
49.
Was founded in the year of the Whopper by a nail-tough old chronic drug addict and alcoholic who had spent the bulk of his adult life under the supervision of the Massachusetts Department of Corrections before discovering the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at MDC Walpole and undergoing a sudden experience of total self-surrender and spiritual awakening in the shower during his fourth month of continuous AA sobriety. This recovered addict-slash-alcoholic, who in his new humility so valued AA's tradition of anonymity that he refused even to use his first name, and was known in Boston AA simply as the guy who didn't even use his first name, opened Ennett House within a year of his parole, determined to pass on to other chronic drug addicts and alcoholics what had been so freely given to him in the E-tier shower. Ennett House leases a former physician's dormitory in the Enfield Marine Public Health Hospital complex, managed by the United States Veterans Administration. Ennett House is equipped to provide 22 male and female clients a 9-month period of closely supervised residency and treatment. Ennett House was not only founded but originally renovated, furnished, and decorated by the nameless local AA ex-con who, since sobriety doesn't exactly mean instant sainthood, used to lead select teams of early recovery dope fiends on after-hours boosting expeditions at area furniture and housewares establishments. This legendary anonymous founder was an extremely tough old Boston AA galoot who believed passionately that everyone, no matter how broad the trail of slime they dragged in behind them, deserved the same chance at sobriety through utterly total surrender he'd been granted. It's a kind of extremely tough love found almost exclusively in tough old Boston galoots.
50.
He sometimes, the founder, in the house's early days, required incoming residents to attempt to eat rocks, as in, like, rocks from the ground, to demonstrate their willingness to go to any lengths for the gift of sobriety. The Massachusetts Department of Public Health's Division of Substance Abuse Services eventually requested that this practice be discontinued. Ennett was not any part of the nameless Ennett House founder's name, by the way. The rock thing, which has become a grim bit of mythopoeia, now trotted out to illustrate how cushy the present Ennett residents have it, was probably not as wacko as it seemed to Division of SAS,
Since many of the things veteran AAs ask newcomers to do and believe seem not much less wacko than trying to chew feldspar. E.g., be so strung out you can feel your pulse in your eyeballs. Have the shakes so badly you make a spatter painting on the wall every time somebody hands you a cup of coffee. Have the life forms out of the corner of your eye be your only distraction from the chainsaw racing chatter in your head, sitting there, and have some old lady with cat hair on her nylons come at you to hug you and tell you to make a list of all the things you're grateful for today. You'll wish you had some feldspar handy, too. In the year of the Yushityu 2007 mimetic resolution cartridge, view motherboard easy-to-install upgrade for Infernitron interlace, TP systems for home, office, or mobile, the nameless founder's death of a cerebral hemorrhage at age 68 went unremarked outside the Boston AA community.
51.
From internal interlace system email memo CAH-NNE22-3575634-22. Claims Adjustment Headquarters, State Farm Insurance Companies, Inc., Bloomington, Illinois, 26th of June, Year of Dairy Products, from the American Heartland. From Murray F. at CLMSHQNNE22.626.intcom to Powell G. / Sanchez M. / Perry K. at CLMHQNNE.626.intcom. Message. Guys, get a load. My definition of a bad day. Metro Boston Region 22 this spring. Comp claim. Witnesses deposed by Boston Workman's Comp. Establish claimant impaired. And the emergency room report lists a blood alcohol of 0.3%, so be pleased to know we're clear on the 357-5 liability end. But basic facts below confirmed by witnesses and CYD accident report. Here's just the first page. Get a load. Murray F. at CLMSHQNNE22.626.intcom. 626-YDPAH 011-2317/page 1. Dwayne R. Glynn, 176 North Faneuil Boulevard, Stoneham, Massachusetts. 021808754/4. June 21st, YODPFTAH. Workman's Accident Claims Office, State Farm Insurance, 1 State Farm Plaza, Normal, Illinois. 617-0622-62/6. Dear Sir, I'm writing in response to your request for additional information. In block number 3 of the accident reporting form, I put trying to do the job alone as the cause of my accident. You said in your letter that I should explain more fully, and I trust that the following details will be sufficient. I am a bricklayer by trade. On the day of the accident, March 27th, I was working alone on the roof of a new six-story building. When I completed my work, I discovered that I had about 900 kilograms of brick left over. Rather than laboriously carry the bricks down by hand, I decided to lower them in a barrel by using a pulley which fortunately was attached to the side of the building at the sixth floor. Securing the rope at ground level, I went up to the roof, swung the barrel out, and loaded the brick into it. Then I went back to the ground and untied the rope, holding it tightly to ensure a slow descent of the 900 kilograms of bricks. You will note in block number 11 of the accident reporting form that I weigh 75 kilograms. Due to my surprise at being jerked off the ground so suddenly, I lost my presence of mind and forgot to let go of the rope. Needless to say, I proceeded at a rapid rate up the side of the building. In the vicinity of the third floor, I met the barrel coming down. This explains the fractured skull and the broken collarbone. Slowed only slightly, I continued my rapid ascent, not stopping until the fingers of my right hand were 2 knuckles deep into the pulleys. Fortunately, by this time, I had regained my presence of mind and was able to hold tightly to the rope in spite of considerable pain. At approximately the same time, however, The barrel of bricks hit the ground, and the bottom fell out of the barrel from the force of hitting the ground. Devoid of the weight of the bricks, the barrel now weighed approximately 30 kilograms. I refer you again to my weight of 75 kilograms in block number 11. As you could imagine, still holding the rope, I began a rather rapid descent from the pulley down the side of the building. In the vicinity of the third floor, I met the barrel coming up. This accounts for the two fractured ankles and the laceration of my legs and lower body. The encounter with the barrel slowed me enough to lessen my impact with the brick-strewn ground below. I am sorry to report, however, that as I lay there on the bricks in considerable pain, unable to stand or move, and watching the empty barrel six stories above me, I again lost my presence of mind and unfortunately let go of the rope, causing the barrel to begin a... End transmission. Intcom. 626. Howland Condenses, first extant written comment on anything, even remotely filmic. Submitted in Mr. Ogilvie's 7th grade Introduction to Entertainment Studies, 2 terms required. Enfield Tennis Academy, 21 February in the year of the Purdue Wonder Chicken. 4 years after the demise of broadcast television, 1 year after Dr. James O. Incandenza passed from this life, a submission receiving just a B/B-, despite overall positive feedback, mostly because its concluding was neither set up by the essay's body nor supported, Ogilvie pointed out, by anything more than subjective intuition and rhetorical flourish. Chief Steve McGarrett of Hawaii 5-0 and Captain Frank Farillo of Hill Street Blues are useful for seeing how our North American idea of the hero changed from the B.S. 1970s era of Hawaii 5-0 to the B.S. 1980s era of Hill Street Blues. Chief Steve McGarrett is a classically modern hero of action. He acts out. It is what he does. The camera is always on him. He is hardly ever off screen. He has just one case per week. The audience knows what the case is and also knows by the end of Act 1 who is guilty. Because the audience knows the truth before Steve McGarrett does, there is no mystery. There is only Steve McGarrett. The drama of Hawaii 5-0 is watching the hero in action, watching Steve McGarrett stalk and strut, homing in on the truth. Homing in is the essence of what the classic hero of modern action does. Steve McGarrett is not weighed down by administrative state police chief chores, or by females, or friends, or emotions, or any sorts of conflicting demands on his attention. His field of action is bare of diverting clutter. Thus, Chief Steve McGarrett single-mindedly acts to refashion a truth the audience already knows into an object of law, justice, modern heroism. In contrast, Captain Frank Farillo is what used to be designated a postmodern hero, viz., a hero whose virtues are suited to a more complex and corporate American era, i.e., a hero of reaction. Captain Frank Farillo does not investigate cases or single-mindedly home in. He commands a precinct. He is a bureaucrat, and his heroism is bureaucratic, with a genius for navigating cluttered fields. In each broadcast episode of Hill Street Blues, Captain Frank Farillo is beset by petty distractions on all sides from the very beginning of Act 1. Not one, but 11 complex cases, each with suspects and snitches and investigating officers and angry community leaders and victims' families, all clamoring for redress. Hundreds of tasks to delegate, egos to massage, promises to make, promises from last week to keep. 2 or 3 cops' domestic troubles, payroll vouchers, duty logs, corruption to be tempted by and agonized over. A police chief who is a political parody, a hyperactive son, an ex-wife who haunts the frosted glass cubicle that serves as Frank Farillo's office, whereas Steve McGarrett's B.S. 1970s office more closely resembled the libraries of landed gentry, hushed behind 2 heavy doors and wainscoted in thick tropical oak, plus a coldly attractive public defendress who wants to talk about did this subject get Mirandized in Spanish, and can Frank stop coming too soon? He came too soon again last night. Maybe he should get into some kind of stress counseling.
plus all the weekly moral dilemmas and double binds his even-handed bureaucratic heroism gets Captain Frank Furillo into. Captain Frank Furillo of Hill Street Blues is a postmodern hero, a virtuoso of triage and compromise in administration. Frank Furillo retains his sanity, composure, and superior grooming in the face of a barrage of distracting, unheroic demands that would have left Chief Steve McGarrett slumped, unkempt, and chewing his knuckle in administrative confusion. In further contrast to Chief Steve McGarrett, Captain Frank Furillo is rarely filmed tight or full front. He is usually one part of a frenetic moving pan by the program's camera. In contrast, Hawaii Five-O's camera crew never even used a dolly, favoring a steady tripodic close-up on McGarrett's face that today seems more reminiscent of romantic portraiture than film drama. What kind of hero comes after McGarrett's Irishized modern cowboy, the lone man of action riding lonely herd in paradise? Furillo's is a whole different kind of loneliness. The postmodern hero was an heroic part of the herd, responsible for all of what he is part of, responsible to everyone, his lonely face as placid under pressure as a cow's face. The jut-jawed hero of action, Hawaii Five-O, becomes the mild-eyed hero of reaction, Hill Street Blues, a decade later. And, as we have observed thus far in our class, we, as a North American audience, have favored the more stoic corporate hero of reactive probity ever since. Some might be led to argue trapped in the reactive moral ambiguity of post and post-post modern culture. But what comes next? What North American hero can hope to succeed the placid Frank? We await, I predict, the hero of non-action, the catatonic hero, the one beyond calm, divorced from all stimulus, carried here and there across sets by burly extras whose blood sings with retrograde amines. Enormous electrolysis-rashed journalist Helen Steeples' only putative published article before beginning her soft profile on Phoenix Cardinals punter Orin J. Incandenza, and her only putative published article to have anything overtly to do with good old metropolitan Boston. The 10th of August, in the year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. 4 years after optical theorist, entrepreneur, tennis academician, and avant-garde filmmaker James O. Incandenza took his own life by putting his head in a microwave oven. Moment magazine has learned that the tragic fate of the second North American citizen to receive a Jarvik 9 exterior artificial heart has sadly been kept from the North American people. The woman, a 46-year-old Boston accountant with irreversible restenosis of the heart, responded so well to the replacement of her defective heart with a Jarvik 9 exterior artificial heart that within weeks she was able to resume the active lifestyle she had so enjoyed before stricken, pursuing her active schedule with the extraordinary prosthesis portably installed in a stylish Etienne Aynier purse. The heart's ventricular tubes ran up to shunts in the woman's arms and ferried life-giving blood back and forth between her living, active body and the extraordinary heart in her purse. Her tragic, untimely, and some might say cruelly ironic fate, however, has been the subject of the all-too-frequent silence needless tragedies are buried beneath when they cast the callous misunderstanding of public officials in the negative light of public knowledge. It took the sort of searching and fearless journalistic doggedness readers have come to respect in Moment to unearth the tragically negative facts of her fate. The 46-year-old recipient of the Jarvik 9 exterior artificial heart was actively window shopping in Cambridge, Massachusetts' fashionable Harvard Square when a transvestite purse snatcher, a drug addict with a criminal record all too well known to public officials, bizarrely outfitted in a strapless cocktail dress, spike heels, tattered feather boa, and auburn wig, brutally tore the life-sustaining purse from the woman's unwitting grasp. The active, alert woman gave chase to the purse-snatching woman for as long as she could, plaintively shouting to passers-by by the words, "Stop her! She stole my heart," on the fashionable sidewalk crowded with shoppers, reportedly shouting repeatedly,
She stole my heart. Stop her. In response to her plaintive calls, tragically, misunderstanding shoppers and passers-by merely shook their heads at one another, smiling knowingly at what they ignorantly presumed to be yet another alternative lifestyles relationship gone sour. A duo of Cambridge, Massachusetts patrolmen, whose names are being withheld from Moment's dogged queries, were publicly heard to passively quip, "Happens all the time," as the victimized woman staggered frantically past in the wake of the fleet transvestite, shouting for help for her stolen heart. That the prosthetic crime victim gave spirited chase for over 4 blocks before collapsing onto her empty chest is testimony to the impressive capacity of the Jarvik 9 replacement procedure, was the anonymous comment of a public medical official reached for comment by Moment. The drug-crazed purse snatcher, informed officials passively speculated, may have found even his hardened conscience moved by the life-saving prosthesis the ill-gotten woman's Aignier purse revealed, which runs on the same rechargeable power cell as an electric man's razor, and may well have continued to beat and bleed for a period of time in the rudely disconnected purse. The purse snatcher's response to this conscience appears to have been cruelly striking the Jarvik 9 exterior artificial heart repeatedly with a stone or small hammer-like tool, for its remains were found some hours later behind the historic Boston Public Library in fashionable Copley Square. Is medical science's awe-inspiring march forward, however, always doomed to include such tragic incidents of ignorance and callous loss, one might ask? Such seems to be the stance of North American officials. If indeed so, the victim's fate is frequently kept from the light of public knowledge. And the facts of the case's outcome? The 46-year-old deceased woman's formerly active, alert brain was removed and dissected 6 weeks later by a Brigham and Women's City of Boston Hospital medical student, reportedly so moved by her terse toe-tags account of the victim's heartless fate that he confessed to Moment a temporary inability to physically wield the power saw of his assigned task. Groups whose opposition to interdependence/reconfiguration is designated by RCMP and USOUS as terrorist/extortionist in character. Alphabetic tally of separatistur anti-ONAN groups whose opposition to interdependence/reconfiguration is designated by RCMP and USOUS as terrorist/extortionist in character. Q equals Quebecois, E equals environmental, S equals separatist, V equals violent, VV equals extremely violent. Les assassins de fauteuil roulant, Q, S, VV. Le bloc Quebecois, Q, S, E. Calgarian pro-Canadian phalanx, E, V. Les fils de Montcalm, Q, E. Les fils de Papineau, Q, S, V. Le Front de la Libération de la Québec, Q, S, V, V. Le Parti Québécois, Q, S, E. Why, though in the early days of interlaces, interneted teleputers that operated off largely the same fiber digital grid as the phone companies, the advent of video telephoning, a.k.a. videophony, enjoyed an interval of huge consumer popularity, callers thrilled at the idea of phone interfacing both orally and facially, the little first-generation phone video cameras being too crude and narrow-apertured for anything much more than facial close-ups, on first-generation teleputers that at that time were little more than high-tech TV sets, though, of course, they had that little intelligent agent homuncular icon that would appear at the lower right of a broadcast cable program and tell you the time and temperature outside, or remind you to take your blood pressure medication, or alert you to a particularly compelling entertainment option now coming up on channel like
491 or something. Or, of course, now alerting you to an incoming video phone call. And then, tap dancing with a little iconic straw boater and cane, just under a menu of possible options for response. And callers did love their little homuncular icons. But why, within like 16 months or 5 sales quarters, the tumescent demand curve for videophony suddenly collapsed, like a kicked tent, so that, by the year of the Depend Adult Undergarment, fewer than 10% of all private telephone communications utilized any video, image fiber data transfers, or coincident products and services, the average U.S. phone user deciding that she, he, actually preferred the retrograde old low-tech Bell-era voice-only telephonic interface after all.
A preferential about-face that cost a good many precipitant video telephony-related entrepreneurs their shirts.
Plus destabilizing two highly respected mutual funds that had ground-floored heavily in video phone technology, and very nearly wiping out the Maryland State Employees Retirement System's Freddie Mac Fund, a fund whose administrator's mistress's brother had been an almost manically precipitant video phone technology entrepreneur. And but so, why the abrupt consumer retreat back to good old voice-only telephoning? The answer, in a kind of trivalent nutshell, is 1. Emotional stress, 2. Physical vanity, and 3. A certain queer kind of self-obliterating logic in the microeconomics of consumer high-tech. 1. It turned out that there was something terribly stressful about visual telephone interfaces that hadn't been stressful at all about voice-only interfaces. Videophone consumers seemed suddenly to realize that they'd been subject to an insidious but wholly marvelous delusion about conventional, voice-only telephony. They'd never noticed it before, the delusion. It's like it was so emotionally complex that it could be countenanced only in the context of its loss. Good old traditional audio-only phone conversations allowed you to presume that the person on the other end was paying complete attention to you, while also preventing you not to have to pay anything even close to complete attention to her. A traditional, oral-only conversation, utilizing a handheld phone whose earpiece contained only 6 little pinholes, but whose mouthpiece, rather significantly, it later seemed, contained 6 to the second power, or 36 little pinholes, let you enter a kind of highway hypnotic semi-attentive fugue. While conversing, you could look around the room, doodle, fine groom, peel tiny bits of dead skin away from your cuticles, compose phone pad haiku, stir things on the stove. You could even carry on a whole separate additional sign language and exaggerated facial expression type of conversation with people right there in the room with you, all while seeming to be right there attending closely to the voice on the phone. And yet, and this was the retrospectively marvelous part, even as you were dividing your attention between the phone call and all sorts of other idle little fugue-like activities, you were somehow never haunted by the suspicion that the person on the other end's attention might be similarly divided. During a traditional call, for example, as you, let's say, performed a close tactile blemish scan of your chin, you were in no way oppressed by the thought that your phone mate was, perhaps, also devoting a good percentage of her attention to a close, tactile blemish scan. It was an illusion, and the illusion was oral and orally supported. The phone line's other end's voice was dense, tightly compressed, and vectored right into your ear, enabling you to imagine that the voice's owner's attention was similarly compressed and focused, even though your own attention was not, was the thing. This bilateral illusion of unilateral attention was almost infantilely gratifying from an emotional standpoint. You got to believe you were receiving somebody's complete attention without having to return it. Regarded with the objectivity of hindsight, the illusion appears irrational, almost literally fantastic. It would be like being able both to lie
and to trust other people at the same time.
Video telephony rendered the fantasy insupportable.
Callers now found that they had to compose the same sort of earnest, slightly over-intense listener's expression they had to compose for in-person exchanges. Those callers who out of unconscious habit succumbed to fugue-like doodling or pants crease adjustment now came off looking rude, absent-minded, or childishly self-absorbed. Callers who even more unconsciously blemish-scanned or nostril-explored looked up to find horrified expressions on the video faces at the other end, all of which resulted in videophonic stress. Even worse, of course, was the traumatic expulsion from Eden feeling of looking up from tracing your thumb's outline on the reminder pad, or adjusting the old unit's angle of repose in your shorts, and actually seeing your videophonic interfacee idly strip a shoelace of its gumlet as she talked to you, and suddenly realizing your whole infantile fantasy of commanding your partner's attention while you yourself got to fugue doodle and make little genital adjustments was deluded and insupportable, and that you were actually commanding not one bit more attention than you were paying here. The whole attention business was monstrously stressful, video callers found. 2. And the videophonic stress was even worse if you were at all vain. That is, if you worried at all about how you looked, as in to other people. Which, all kidding aside, who doesn't? Good old oral telephone calls could be fielded without makeup, toupee, surgical prosthesis, etc. Even without clothes, if that sort of thing rattled your saber. But for the image conscious, there was, of course, no such answer-as-you-are informality about visual video telephone calls, which consumers began to see were less like having the good old phone ring than having the doorbell ring, and having to throw on clothes and attach prostheses and do hair checks in the foyer mirror before answering the door.
But the real coffin nail for videophony involved the way callers' faces looked on their TP screen during calls.
Not their callers' faces, but their own when they saw them on video. It was a three-button affair, after all, to use the TP's cartridge card's video record option to record both pulses in a two-way visual call and play the call back, and see how your face had actually looked to the other person during the call. This sort of appearance check was no more resistible than a mirror, but the experience proved almost universally horrifying. People were horrified at how their own faces appeared on a TP screen. It wasn't just Anchorman's bloat, that well-known impression of extra weight that video inflicts on the face. It was worse. Even with high-end TP's high-def viewer screens, consumers perceived something essentially blurred and moist-looking about their phone faces. A shiny, pallid indefiniteness that struck them as not just unflattering, but somehow evasive, furtive, untrustworthy, unlikable. In an early and ominous Interlace/GTE focus group survey that was all but ignored in a storm of entrepreneurial sci-fi tech enthusiasm, almost 60% of respondents who received visual access to their own faces during videophonic calls specifically used the terms untrustworthy, unlikable, or hard to like in describing their own visage's appearance, with a phenomenally ominous 71% of senior citizen respondents specifically comparing their video faces to that of Richard Nixon during the Nixon-Kennedy debates of B.S. 1960. The proposed solution to what the telecommunications industry's psychological consultants termed video physiognomic dysphoria, or VPD, was of course the advent of high-definition masking. And in fact, it was those entrepreneurs who gravitated toward the production of high-definition videophonic imaging and then outright masks who got in and out of the short-lived videophonic era with their shirts plus solid additional nets. Mask-wise, the initial option of high-definition photographic imaging, that is, taking the most flattering elements of a variety of flattering multi-angle photos of a given phone consumer and, thanks to existing image configuration equipment already pioneered by the cosmetics and law enforcement industries, combining them into a wildly attractive high-def, broadcastable composite of a face wearing an earnest, slightly over-intense expression of complete attention, was quickly supplanted by the more inexpensive and bite-economical option of, using the exact same cosmetic and FBI software, actually casting the enhanced facial image in a form-fitting polybutylene resin mask. And consumers soon found that the high upfront cost of a permanent wearable mask was more than worth it, considering the stress and VPD reduction benefits. And the convenient Velcro straps for the back of the mask and caller's head caused peanuts. And for a couple fiscal quarters, phone/cable companies were able to rally VPD-afflicted consumers' confidence by working out a horizontally integrated deal where free composite and masking services came with a video phone hookup. The high-def masks were not in use, simply hung on a small hook on the side of a TP's phone console, admittedly looking maybe a bit surreal and discomforting when detached and hanging there empty and wrinkled, and sometimes there were potentially awkward mistaken identity snafus involving multi-user family or company phones, and the hurried selection and attachment of the wrong mask taken from some long row of empty hanging masks. But all in all, the masks seemed initially like a viable industry response to the vanity, stress, and Nixonian facial image problem.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.